Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer. Is there anything cooler or wackier or stranger than nature? The forms that plants can take, that animals can take, that ecological systems can take can be mind-blowing. And so it should come as no surprise that the emperors of all things mind-blowing in the book business, the folks from Atlas Obscura, have a wonderful new book out that will blow your mind. It's called Atlas Obscura Wildlife, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. And to help me discuss some of the crazy things in this book, I have Dylan Thuris, who is one of the founders of Atlas Obscura, along with Joshua Foer, who is not here today, but who was the co-author of this book. We have the other co-author. She is Kara Jaimo. Welcome, you guys, to the Frommer Travel Show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us here,
Paul. Yeah, thank you.
So I got to ask, how did you come up with the decision to do this book?
Yeah, We started with Atlas Obscura. And so we started with this, you know, lens on the world that had to do with place and how finding the most unusual and interesting places in the world starts to kind of open up your lens of what you even think is possible. You start to go, oh, actually, I've been thinking about the world in much too narrow a way. It's much bigger and much stranger than I was maybe realizing. And our follow-on to that book was Gastro Obscura, which was all about taking the lens of food, but applying it similarly so that, you know, every single dish that you eat is actually also this journey into place and history and culture. And so it's a really beautiful way of exploring the world. And we just realized that another way we really wanted to do that was through animals and plants, through living creatures that, honestly, as you said at the top of the show, it might be the weirdest possible version of the world. In fact, it's actually so much weirder than almost anything humans can think of or do exists in the natural world around us. So yeah, that was kind of our inspiration. And then Kara is just like, this is her world. It was so obvious from the moment we even contemplated that this would be an interesting way to approach writing about travel, that Kara would be the person to do this.
Yeah.
So Kara, I'll let you kind of talk about.
So Kara, you do something very smart in the introduction. You started with the weirdest animal on the planet, which is Homo sapiens, human beings. Why did you want to frame the book in that way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I thought a lot about how to start this book because it's pretty hard to start any book. You need to kind of get people interested from the very beginning, and you need to show them how you're going to approach whatever topic you're exploring. When I was writing this book, I was thinking a lot about the fact that humans really like to write about animals and plants and to describe them and to depict them, and that we've actually been doing this for a really, really, really long time. And it's one of the things that sets us apart from other creatures. Like, the more I wrote this book, the more my list of things that only humans do got shorter and shorter and shorter. But I think, you know, like, writing about, thinking about, telling stories about creatures other than ourselves is, I think it's pretty unique to us. Other animals can have obviously like very deep relationships with other species, but I don't think they care quite so much about the storytelling aspect and about the need to kind of like collect all this information and have it in one place. So yeah. I decided to start with humans because that aspect of us became very special to me as I was working on the book, and I wanted to point it out and I wanted to frame that the book that way so that when people read it, they realize that they're part of a long legacy of this activity.
Right, right. And I think one of the misconceptions about what animals don't do for a long time, it's been, you know, kicked to the curb now, is that they're not architects. And yet you start the book, the very first animal you portray is tent-making bats. This just blew my mind, the complexity of what these bats do to create homes for themselves. I had no idea that bats even created homes. I just thought they hung there. So talk about tent-making bats and where you can find them and what they do.
Yeah, gladly. So I love bats. I think they have kind of a bad reputation, but they're really interesting and exciting and cute. Tent-making bats especially are cute. A lot of them just look like little cotton balls. And like you said, bats like to have shelter. And the bats that we encounter most of the time in North America tend to live in existing shelters, whether that's a cave or even like a man-made bridge, they'll find a place where they can all gather. But in Central and South America, as well as parts of Asia, there are bats that build their own houses. And they do it usually using leaves. So they will chew certain parts of a leaf and fold them and adhere them together to make these tents. And then they'll sleep often in cute little family groups inside the tents. And these tents protect them from the weather. They allow them to have a cozy place to be together. And they also hide them from any predators that might be coming by. So they're very useful.
And some of them actually rustle if they're touched. And so these are like inbuilt alarm systems. And you talk about how certain bats make the same type of tent over and over and over, and others are more creative, right?
I think that, you know, the way that creatures interact with their environments is always really fascinating to me. And yes, there's some, you know, combination of instinct and maybe some learning happening here where some bats always do the same thing because it always works, and then others have different strategies.
Now, one of the major, I would say, tourism creating animals in the book, of an animal that people actually make special trips to see, are the pink dolphins. And those also are in South and Central America, and they're inland. Tell us a little bit about how they came to be where they are. And I don't think you cover this in the book, but do we know why they're pink?
Yeah, Dylan, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say one thing, and I don't think we've ever talked about this, Kara. I actually have seen a pink dolphin in person.
Oh, cool.
When Josh and I went on this trip through South America, like forever ago now, we were boating through the Amazon on these smaller rivers, and we just happened to come across one. And it was great. They were really small, like really little. And you could spot it right away because of its color. And our guides were like, oh, that's a big deal. He's like, it's very unusual to see them. You know, I know that they're born not pink and become pink over time, which is like a very interesting aspect of them. They're, I don't know exactly why. I mean, why they are where they are, I think, as far as I know, just has to do with like, there being an ecosystem that they can thrive in there.
Yeah, I think so. What I learned while researching was that there used to be kind of like an inland ocean in South America long, long time ago, like 16 million years ago. And when that ocean receded, the dolphins kind of got stuck. And so they figured out how to live in these rivers. And they have these interesting ways of being that ocean dolphins don't have, where they're particularly agile. They have these really skinny, long beaks that they can use to dig with. They're very, very cool.
Yeah. And they hold up clods of dirt and branches of trees to mate with one another. Kind of like a look what I got here, babe. Fascinating part of the book. You also talk about, and I hope I'm going to pronounce this right, Marimo balls, which of course, exist in Japan and elsewhere. They look like they would exist in Japan. In the book, you show them they're these kind of fuzzy green balls that float to the top of lakes during the day and sink at night. And they're very mysterious. So which one of you guys, either one, would like to discuss this?
Go for it, Kara. Speaking of cute things, it's like funny to describe botanical things as cute. Like, you don't normally describe plant life as cute, but these are the cutest little.
Yeah, they're perfect spheres. They're absolutely round, which is so wacky to see in nature.
They are super cute. They're also not the only sort of like mysteriously mobile moss in the book. Something like, there's another thing called glacier mice, which are also moss balls that like move around on glaciers later on in the book. So it's something that moss seems to do. The glacier mice, we still don't understand. The Marimo balls, we have gotten a little bit of insight into how it works. So in the daytime, when the moss is getting sunlight, it photosynthesizes, and that creates tiny little bubbles of oxygen, because that's the product of photosynthesis. And so the bubbles gather, and it's almost like a little buoy for the balls. So over the course of the day, they rise up thanks to these little bubbles. And then at night, when photosynthesis stops, they slowly sink back down. But yeah, they are really cute. And they almost are like when you go to the dentist and they have like a calming fish tank or like like a lava lamp. It's like a combo. It's like a living little lava lamp just going up and down over the course of a day.
Yeah, no, fascinating. And we started out by talking about things that we thought humans do that animals don't. One of those things, I think, well, maybe not, is migration, is travel, taking vacations, damn it. And many, many creatures do that. So let's talk about some of the more interesting ones, how they do it, why they do it. One of the biggest tourist attractions in Africa, or in the safari parts of Africa, the places people go to see this, is the wildebeest migration. Can you talk, one of you talk a little bit about that?
Just like migrations generally or specifically?
Well, generally. I mean, migrations, is it always following the food and what is growing in different areas, or do animals migrate for different reasons?
I do think that usually they are looking for something, you know, and sometimes that doesn't necessarily mean they wake up one morning and they say, I'm like, oh, there's no food here. I gotta move. It's more of a generational inbuilt pattern. Like, they just have to do it. But yeah, they're usually looking for food. They are looking for just a more hospitable place to be, just like humans when they migrate, like you said, moving around is just part of how they do that.
Climactic reasons obviously drive a huge amount of it. Like, food drives it, but so does just weather and seasons. I mean, you think about birds' migration, and a lot of that just has to do with finding temperate areas to be. And part of that's driven by food as well. I mean, I think we have a story. This goes all the way back to the first book, but, you know, for such a long time, we didn't understand bird migration at all. Like, there was a million theories, you know, early theories, like ancient theories were like, they go to the moon they bury themselves under the mud and they like hide all winter. Cause all that is actually something that other animals did. And 2000 years ago, the idea is that maybe birds were going to the moon was like not such a wacky, it was just like, okay, where are they going? And then, you know, people started to develop these theories around travel to other parts of the world. But I think it was either the 1700s or 1800s. When they ended up finding this stork in Germany that had a full-sized African spear sticking through its neck. It had flown the entire migratory journey with this spear, and this bird became actually an important piece of evidence for this theory of migration about how birds were traveling and where they were going and how far they were going. People kind of couldn't believe, actually, oh, these birds are not just, you know, they're not just going one town over or something. They are really traveling hundreds and thousands of miles. So I love that story because it's, you know.
And what's
the other thing I'll say, actually, is like one of the things you run into when you are looking at the natural world is it may feel obvious to us now, like this question about bird migration, but there's actually still so many mysteries like this. There's still so many things in the natural world. I mean, famously, like eels, their life cycle, where they go to mate, all of this remains relatively unclear. It's getting slightly clearer over time, but there's just, the natural world remains actually full of these enormous mysteries that maybe someday someone will look back at us talking about this stuff and think,
right,
how ridiculous that they thought that this was the way it was working. So,
and talking about migrations, you know, birds, we know now that's pretty obvious. We see them going north. We know they're migrating. But there are other creatures that I never would have guessed migrate, like the Caribbean spiny lobster. You write, every autumn, populations of these spiky crustaceans march for miles from the shallows into deeper waters, and they're lined up, antenna to tail, to reduce drag. So not only are they migrating, they're doing it in a very military formation and a smart way so that they can do it efficiently. I thought that was mind-blowing.
Yeah, there's so much happening underwater that we really don't understand. Like Dylan was saying, there are always new frontiers of information that we have only begun to explore, and undersea life is one of them right now. And there's an interesting thing happening right now where, as we explore the seabed more, mostly because we want to like extract stuff from it, like minerals, mining, gas, we are learning more and more about who lives there. And I think we used to assume like, oh, who could possibly live at the bottom of the sea? That seems very difficult. In reality, there are all of these fascinating things happening there that are in some ways similar to, and in some ways completely fascinatingly different from what's happening on land that we never imagined. So the spiny lobsters, you know, it's lucky that somebody happened to see that and figure out what was going on. That kind of thing is probably happening all over the place, and we just have no way of knowing yet. So that is also something to keep in mind, especially with the ocean.
Well, speaking about underwater mysteries, this isn't the ocean, but the devil's hole pupfish. Mm. Wow. They live in a place that no living being really should be able to survive in. Would one of you tell the story about how they got there, how they survive, and what their lives are like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll start by saying, I think they might be Kara, correct me if you think this isn't right, but I think they may be the rarest fish effectively in the world, right? They have like a population in the hundred, like 100 and some, you know. It's a very specific environment and you know, confines for a species to live in. Kara, maybe you can give a good explanation of how.
Well, tell us where they are first, and why it's so hard for them to live.
Yes, so they live in one little watery hole in Death Valley. So I was actually really excited to start off the deserts chapter of this book with a fish, because it was like, this is like the last thing you are probably going to expect to see when you turn the page after it says deserts. They live in this little hole. Dylan, I don't know if they're the rarest fish in the world, but they got to be up there.
Got to be up there.
Yeah. No one is totally sure how they got there. It's possible that there was like, during a different climate regime where the area was pretty wet, there was a flood and they kind of washed in there, and then everything dried out and they got stuck. Maybe there were passageways from a different cavern far away that were more open at some point, and some fish like swam through and ended up there. And then there is sort of a more niche theory that indigenous Americans stocked the pool on purpose to fish from, which is kind of interesting. But
it's in a cavern in Death Valley.
Death Valley, yeah. And
so incredibly hot.
Yes.
And like 90 degrees heat.
More yeah.
It's actually quite dangerous.
Oh, the pool itself. Yeah.
It's
degrees.
Dangerous to research these fish because it's like a deep pool. It's hot. The water itself is hot. And it's a number of people who have tried to dive this pool have died doing it, because it's very like labyrinthian underwater passageways. I mean, there's still questions. I mean, people have tried to figure out, are they connecting to Mono Lake? Are they connecting to a different body of water? Kind of, are they confined under there? They're not actually the only kind of fish that's sort of confined to a weird underground, like cave water system, but it's just like, it makes it very hard to study. It's very dangerous and difficult just to study them.
So I guess there's no way you can visit them as a tourist. You're never going to see these pupfish, probably.
You can go to the hole. You can definitely go to the devil's hole.
You can, yeah. And if you bring binoculars or a birding scope, you can probably see them. But you can't get up super close, and it's not, you can't swim in there. It's very illegal. People have gotten in big trouble.
Don't do it.
But yeah, you can see them. And whenever I fly over Death Valley, I always tell myself I'm seeing them. Just from very far away.
Well, the fascinating factoid that you had in this listing about the pufffish is the caverns are so deep there that when there is an earthquake in China, the water ripples in these caverns, meaning that this could be part of a worldwide underground system.
Yeah, the world is very big, but then it's also very connected. It's interesting to remember that.
Absolutely. All right. Exploding ants. This made me think about suicide bombers. This made me think about war and very dark human history. Who knew this existed in the animal world? Well, so tell us about exploding ants, Dylan.
Well, I'll just start by saying ants put us to shame. As far as like warfare, like we may think we're like a violent species, like ants put us wildly to shame. They are in a constant, I mean, generally across, I mean, there's many, many different species and there's different behavior among those different species. But in general, the ants wage war against each other in a way that is hard to fathom. And it is funny to sort of think about some of these things like, you know, kamikaze pilots in World War II as like not actually human specific inventions. Like there's some kind of like tactical advantage to that. And so with exploding ants, they've basically evolved that same idea that it's like this provides a tactical advantage to the larger project we're working on, the larger goal at hand.
Yeah.
Because ants work, you know, in this colony fashion towards larger goals. Kara, I don't know what you,
So Kara, tell us about the science of how they explode and when they explode.
Yeah, they're really interesting. Just to riff off of what Dylan was saying, for another part of the book, I was looking into something called eusociality, like EU and then the word sociality. And it's this theory that at some point in an evolutionary process, certain creatures evolve so that individuals work together so closely that they're actually more of like a superorganism. And obviously humans are social, but like Dylan said, we are not social enough to be considered eusocial. We leave that mostly to insects like ants and bees. Certain plants are starting to be considered that way, and also naked mole rats and some other rodents. So these ants are definitely eusocial. They care much less about their individual well-being, and much more of their actions are directed towards the group well-being. In terms of how they actually explode, the worker ants of this type of ant, which the scientific name is Colobopsis explodens, which I think is kind of funny.
Yeah.
They have these glands that make goo that kind of is extra sticky, and they can squeeze their own bodies and the glands will pop, and then they will themselves become stuck. And then whoever's fighting them also just becomes immobilized. It's like a glue trap, but they have it in their own body and they can pop it with such force that it kind of like flies out and helps them, defend their nest is usually how they end up using it. So bigger ants might be invading, they pop, and then the ants have to stop.
And they die in the process. This is not just them pushing out goo. Their whole body explodes.
Yes. Yeah. It's self-sacrificial.
Yeah.
Really.
The colony survives.
Yeah. Now, to talk about another strange creature that is not a bear, but is called the Arctic woolly bear. Kara, can you tell us about that one? It's on page 421 of the book.
Oh, thank you for that. it's a lot of book to keep in one's head.
I know. I tried to give a little bit of notice, but I know there's a lot in here.
No, they're all in there. They're all in here. I got to find
them. This is a wacky caterpillar
yes.
that lives for many years, for up to 7 years, but it doesn't live in a way that we would think of living all the time.
Totally.
So tell us about the Arctic woolly bear.
Yes, so this is an Arctic caterpillar. I'm glad we're talking about multiple insects because I also love insects as well as bats. I like all the weird critters that people are scared of. But these very cute caterpillars, they live in Arctic islands. They're very fuzzy. Because they live in Arctic islands and because insects are cold-blooded and can't really move very quickly without the help of external warmth, they have this really funny life strategy where they basically sleep all the time, they hibernate constantly, except for 3 weeks in June, where they do literally everything else that they're going to do for the whole year. So it's like, imagine you sleep all year, you wake up in June and you're like, I better get everything done because before July, I have to go back to sleep. So they eat, they grow, they sort of, you know, soak up the sun. And then when the time comes, they spin themselves a little sleeping bag and they go to sleep. And then they do it again the next year.
And they often are frozen as they sleep, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. They're able to be frozen. There's a few animals in the book that have something in their blood that allows, it's like an antifreeze, like a natural antifreeze that allows them to survive freezing temperatures, which is very cool.
Yeah, very cool. And another one that has the name Arctic in it. This may change my life, knowing this. The mighty Arctic lichen. I love it's called mighty lichen. Lichen aren't plants. Who knew?
Yeah. Lichen are super interesting. They are sort of
themselves. Is it lichen or lichen or both?
I think it's lichen.
I go lichen. Yeah.
But lichen sounds nice. They are not necessarily a super organism, but they are like a very, very close collaboration between fungus and algae, which are life forms from two completely different, you know, biological kingdoms, as far as we know. But they come together to form lichen, which will be familiar to anyone who has like, you know, looked at a rock with a weird green patch on it or like a gravestone. They are very flat, very slow growing assemblages of fungus and algae. So the fungus kind of provides the structure and then the algae provides the food because it can photosynthesize. And
so lichen is actually two creatures in one then?
It's two creatures in one, but they're sort of inseparable. Like you can't really get one without the other. It's a very, very old, long-standing partnership and it's very successful. We call these lichens mighty because it's not clear that they ever have to die. Obviously, they do die because they get eaten mostly by reindeer. It's like one of reindeer's favorite foods. But without predation, they might live forever. There's no reason that they age like we do. So it's a very cool thing that they can do.
Yeah, and they're the first to come back after volcanic explosions, too.
Yes.
They also have this incredible generative property.
Yes, they're extremely hardy to most natural things.
And so where would you see them? I guess it says that you would see them if it looks like something threw up on a rock, it's probably a lichen.
Yeah. You can see them all over. Like they grow really well. Lichens in general, not necessarily Arctic lichens, but different species grow really well everywhere. So you might find them growing even like on your porch, like on the wood. You could find them on your steps outside. There's a lot of them on gravestones and actually there's this interesting relationship between cemeteries and the study of lichen because people who were figuring out exactly how long lichen can live used gravestones to figure it out because gravestones have very specific dates.
Oh,
so they're able to say, you know, this stone is this old, this much old, and this lichen is this big. So like, this is probably how long it took it to get this big. So that's also a good place to look for them.
Yeah. All right. And before I let you guys go, it's not only quote unquote nature areas that are in this book. I love the fact that you give a profile to the London Underground mosquitoes. Dylan, how did you decide on London Underground mosquitoes? And are they only in London? And can you tell us about this or should we switch to Kara?
The London Underground mosquitoes, I mean, I think we chose them in part because they are actually like a subspecies classification. Like they are not just like mosquitoes in the subway, which can certainly exist, but they have carved out a more specific niche in the London tube. And so they have a kind of slightly evolutionary different path, which also goes to show you, like, there is nothing, every city that you're in is an active evolving natural landscape. All kinds of animals are coming to understand how to live in that landscape, live in conjunction with the trash and the, obviously, actually the enormous source of additional food, which is like a huge attraction to any species that is adaptable enough. So you end up with all of these species that we have very complicated relationships with and think of as kind of pests, you know, your pigeons, your rats, but even your foxes, your coyotes, your raccoons, bears to a certain degree, like, you know, and so in this case, the mosquito just happened to find a very lovely food source trapped in a metal tube in the humid underground tubes of London, and has slowly sort of started to become its own thing, you know? And I just think there's a real, I mean, it may be quite annoying, but there's a sort of a beauty to it. Like, we, no matter what we do not separate ourselves from the natural world or the evolutionary pressures within that world. Those exist regardless of any of our human plans and machinations, you know? So they're a good example of that. I don't know, maybe there's anything else you feel like we should, maybe there's some good facts I forgot to mention, Kara, about the mosquitoes.
No, that was totally great. And pretty much what I was going to say, we wanted to put a whole chapter about cities in the book because of what Dylan said. We wanted to remind people that cities are alive and that there are interesting natural things going on there. Even if it feels like we control every square inch of the environment, we certainly do not. And more and more we're learning about how other species have taken advantage of these places that we've created, including the subway. And yeah, I agree with Dylan. Like, if you're getting bitten by one, like, obviously, maybe it helps a little bit to remember that you're experiencing something cool, even if it's also a huge pain.
I was gonna say the great thing about Atlas Obscura books is you do tell people how to experience these things. Mm-hmm. I guess we are telling people that you may experience this in the subways of London. So maybe wear long sleeve shirts and pants so you don't get bitten up. I don't know. Totally. Well, it is another mind-blowing, I keep using that word, but it is appropriate, beautifully illustrated, gorgeously written book. So my congratulations to you both. And
thank you.
Thank you so much for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.